Okay, good evening, everybody. My name's David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities and Director of the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI, which is where you're sitting. And it's a very great pleasure to welcome you after a rather longer than intended hiatus to this latest in the series of inaugural lectures that the HRI hosts. These are lectures intended to offer opportunities for recently appointed professors in the Arts and Humanities Division to spell out their vision for the development of their subject, thereby bringing the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience, both within and beyond the university. In the usual way, a recording of this evening's lecture will be made available on the HRI's website as soon as possible. Also in the usual way, we will not subject our lecturer to formal questioning at the end, but there will be a chance for informal conversation over a glass or two of wine immediately after the lecture, and that will be just through in the breakout area there. Now, our lecturer this evening is Professor Penny Ely of the Department of French. And in addition to welcoming Penny, of course, I'd like to extend an especially warm welcome to her colleagues from the department and also to those from her field who have come from further away. It's a matter of great regret that I can't also extend that welcome to Adrian, Penny's husband, who unfortunately is otherwise detained in Toronto this week. Now, Penny's been a member of staff in the Department of French at the university for 23 years now. The brief academic biography that we find on the department's website tells us that before coming to Sheffield, Penny graduated from Somerville College, Oxford, and moved on to University College, Cardiff, where she completed a PhD on the portrayal of the heroine in 12th and early 13th century French narrative. She then spent 2 years as a Killam postdoctoral research fellow at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, working on old French Troy stories. It was during this time that she developed an interest in Quebecois and Acadian literature. After a further year as University of Wales Research Fellow at University College Swansea, she became a lecturer in French at Sheffield in 1984. Was promoted to senior lecturer in 1995 and to reader in 2002, and then to a personal chair last year, 2006. Such are the bare bones of Penny Ely's academic biography. Now, one of the great advantages of introducing an inaugural lecturer who's been around the university for as long as Penny is that there's no shortage of colleagues able to help one to put a certain amount of flesh on those bones. It's at this point that the lecturer ought to begin to shift uneasily and look at the floor in fearful anticipation of a public airing of facts, insinuations, or allegations that she or he had hoped would never go beyond the confines of his or her department. In fact, Penny can confidently hold our collective gaze, because despite my best efforts, I've been unable to discover anything scandalous, scurrilous, or even slightly suspicious about her 23 years at Sheffield. True, one colleague did on the phone this morning suggest that it might be an idea to ask her about the presence of giant toads in her language teaching, which we can perhaps do over drinks afterwards. Not having had myself an opportunity to press Penny about this matter, I can only assume that these oversized amphibians play some part in the excellence of her teaching, which is very widely attested. The head of the French department, David Walker, is unfortunately unable to be here this evening because he's involved in a quality assurance visit to City College in Thessaloniki. But very much along quality assurance lines, he's told me that Penny's student evaluation feedback consistently soars above the average in a department that prides itself on the high quality of its learning and teaching provision. No surprise, then, that in 2005, she was the recipient of a Senate Award for consistent excellence in teaching and learning. No surprise, either, that she is not resting on her laurels. Only yesterday morning, I bumped into Penny here in the HRI building and commented to her that she was clearly taking the advanced preparation for her inaugural lecture extraordinarily seriously. She was turning up 36 hours in advance, or thereabouts. In fact, it turned out that she was on her way to a good practice workshop being run by the Teaching and Learning Support Unit. Now, as a supervisor of research students too, Penny has excelled. Her colleague and collaborator, Penny Simons, tells me that she completed her PhD under her namesake supervision in 1991, at a time when the university was conducting a review, fancy that, of the quality of supervision. In what to someone like me, who has an interest in the twisted politics, both high national and low academic, of the Soviet Union, looks like a confusing act of negative denunciation, Penny Simons wrote an unsolicited, though not, I presume, anonymous, letter to the review committee, pointing out that Penny Ely had provided supervision second to none. Now, as I've just mentioned, Penny and Penny have subsequently collaborated extensively in research. most notably perhaps on an AHRB-funded project led by Penny Ely, which led to the publication in 2005 of an online edition of Partenope de Blois, one of the most popular romances of the Middle Ages. 7 complete manuscripts survive from the late 12th to the 14th centuries, along with 3 fragments. So complex is the textual history of the romance that an innovative approach is required, one that unusually doesn't take a base manuscript as its starting point, but rather allows full and equal consideration and comparison of all the manuscript witnesses. If I sound remotely authoritative here, it's because that's lifted directly from the web pages, of course. Now, the edition, the electronic edition, which is published by the HRI's press, or HRI Online Publications, uses the possibilities of digital technology to ensure that this particular feature of the text can be fully appreciated and represented, and research on it as a result can venture into new areas. I know from my own experience of working as director of the HRI with Penny on this project just how acute is her understanding of the applicability of digital technologies to arts and humanities research, and also, of course, to teaching. She has been a pioneer in computer-assisted language learning. The HRI and the principal investigator in the case of this project were equal partners in ensuring that the technology was fit for the purpose of addressing the project's core research questions. We learned from her as well, we hope, as she from us. Penny has, of course, established a formidable research profile and reputation through more traditional avenues as well, with a substantial number of highly regarded articles, critical editions and translations, arguing her agenda-setting case for the importance of non-canonical 12th century French verse texts. The range of her research is reflected in the information in the announcement of this evening's lecture, which I'm sure you all saw. Many of her articles are co-authored, a true sign of a generous collaborative spirit, a spirit that's also reflected in her serving as president of the British branch of the International Quarterly Literature Society. And as if that were not enough, Penny has also pioneered the study in the French department of Francophone Canadian literature. David Walker has pointed out to me that Penny has what he calls a remarkable way with provocative titles. And he's given me a couple of examples of this. A Tarantula in Your Bed, A Lexical Problem in Partenope de Blois, or The Birds and Quite Possibly the Bees in Partenope de Blois. Apparently, colleagues in the French department who've been regaled with seminars on rude words in medieval literature, textual intercourse, intertextuality and obscenity in old French romance, for instance, have seen even more of her considerable range. Penny has, David assures me, ways of handling audiences that may well disrupt conventional expectations. It is therefore with eager anticipation, not to say trepidation, that I now invite Professor Penny Ely to speak to us on the subject of emotional archaeology on the uses of medieval French literature.
I don't quite know what to say after that, David. Thank you, David, very much for that fulsome introduction. Thank you also for, through the HRI, for hosting this event. I'd also like to thank everyone who's here for coming along. It's lovely to see so many colleagues, friends, neighbours who are present. It's also nice to welcome 3 members of my family, my mother, my sister, and my brother-in-law there. My great sadness is that my father didn't live to see me take up a chair at the university where he was an undergraduate many years ago. So thank you all for coming. Now, those of you who work or have worked with me may be slightly alarmed by the apparent fluffiness of my title, Emotional Archaeology. It's a well-known fact that I don't do fluffy. Let me reassure you straight away that the fluff, such as it is, will prove to be deceptive. Underneath it, there is a hard and serious purpose. Exactly 18 months ago, to the day, Sarah Foote inaugurated this new series of inaugurals with an eloquent, erudite, and passionate defence of her discipline. I do not pretend to rival Sarah in eloquence or erudition, but I am going to follow in her footsteps to the extent of presenting my own apologia pro materia mea. And every inaugural needs some Latin. When I meet people and tell them what I do for a living, I not infrequently get a response along the lines of, but what use is medieval French literature? One answer to that question can, of course, be built around a critique of the utilitarian approach to knowledge, of the idea that knowledge has no value for its own sake, but has to be demonstrably useful for some other purpose. But it's also possible to answer that question in its own terms, and that's the road that I would like to take you down this evening. When I'm asked what use is medieval French literature, I often respond with another question, which is, do you think archaeology is useful? The answer is usually positive, and when I then ask why archaeology is useful, the response is generally couched in terms of the importance of history for understanding ourselves and the world we live in. Archaeology tells us how people lived and died, ate and drank, built and fought in the past, and so enhances our knowledge of human society and of some of the processes that govern human behaviour. But there are some processes that material archaeology, by its very nature, will struggle to illuminate. Archaeology can tell us, for instance, about the popularity and social distribution of chess as a pastime in the European Middle Ages by cataloguing chessboards and chessmen from different sites and looking at the materials from which they are made. But how do we find out about aspects of life that are not embodied in material artefacts, such as what people did for a laugh in the 12th and 13th centuries? How do we discover whether they shared our sense of humour, what sort of jokes they told each other, where the boundaries of socially acceptable and socially unacceptable humour were set? How do we learn about their hopes and fears and the ways in which they adapted psychologically and emotionally to a changing world? This is where literature, and more specifically fiction, which is the area in which I've done most of my research, comes into its own. If it is true that people tell stories in order to explain the world to themselves and to explain themselves to the world, then it follows that by reading medieval stories closely, carefully, and in the context of what we know about the period from other sources, we may be able to hear the men and women of medieval France speaking about themselves and each other in ways that illuminate what we have in common with them and also what was irredeemably different about their world. We can unearth their thoughts and feelings. In other words, we can do emotional archaeology. This, in very broad terms, is the use of old French literature. Underneath this fluffy surface, the demands of the discipline are significant and wide-ranging. Scholars and students of old French literature must, amongst other things, learn a language that has no native speakers. And not simply learn it, but inhabit it, to the extent of recognising how, in his monumental history of the Dukes of Normandy, Benoît de Sade-Maure damns William the Conqueror with faint praise by using only the most conventional adjectives to describe his good qualities, while other characters benefit from a richer and more imaginative vocabulary. This is where the technology gets too complicated. I have to do things with both hands at the same time. Our scholars and students must understand the techniques and processes of manuscript production and the distinguishing features of old French dialects so as to be able to work out what a manuscript such as this has to tell us. This is an image of one page of a manuscript of the 12th century romance Partant pour de Blois, which David has already referred to. I'm having trouble getting it to scroll here. It was made, this manuscript, in northern Italy in the second half of the 13th century. This is the famous manuscript L, which during our project on Partant pour de Blois used to elicit cries of OL every time we had to do anything with it. As you can see, this page was written by two different scribes. The handwriting changes halfway down. In fact, the manuscript was prepared by a group of at least four scribes, some of whom had limited understanding of French, and all of whom appear at times to have been at the Magic Mushrooms. Now, with a detailed enough knowledge of scribes and dialects, it's possible to work out that this manuscript was copied from another manuscript that was made in England. That this English manuscript was not the English manuscript now held in the Vatican Library in Rome, and that therefore this poem must have had a certain popularity among the French-speaking classes in Europe, in England, since at least two, and very probably more, copies were made there. Bear with me while I try and shut this out down. Right. Our scholars and students must also develop cultural understanding to the extent of being able to recognise that when a poet translates the story of Pyramus and Thisbe from Ovid's Metamorphoses into Old French and turns the veil that Ovid's heroine drops on the ground into a wimple, this is not just a process of presenting a classical tale in 12th century dress. Whereas a loose Greek or Roman veil could realistically slip to the ground unnoticed as a young girl fled in terror from a lion, as happens in this story, a wimple could not. As you can see, it was a tube of fabric placed over the head and neck, and in some cases framed the face quite closely. The only way the French Thisbe could drop her wimple was if she'd already removed it and was holding it in her hand. And since the wimple was a garment associated with chastity, which is why it went on to be part of the uniform of nuns, the fact that Thisbe had removed hers signals to the audience that she is a truly transgressive figure in this tale. She is the one who suggests that she and Pyramus should defy their families by meeting outside the city walls to run away together. She is the one who then plans to break the taboo surrounding premarital sex by offering herself to her lover. We must also know enough about the history of natural history to understand that when a lion appears in an old French romance, this is not the sub-Saharan African lion, Panthera leo leo, beloved of BBC wildlife cameraman, but the Asiatic lion, Panthera leo persica, whose range once extended as far west as Greece, and which, like elephants, was associated by the medieval audience with the Orient rather than with Africa. Male Asiatic lions spend long periods away from the small female-dominated pride, sometimes in sibling pairs, sometimes alone. So the lone lions encountered in European wildernesses by the heroes of Partons au Pas de Blois and the romance of Yvain by Chrétien de Troyes are not that unrealistic, and they're not necessarily a sign that we have entered the realms of fantasy in these texts. Since the lion can also represent kingship, the encounter between a European hero and a lion can be read as the meeting of West and East, and the killing or taming of the lion as the desire either for military supremacy over the East or for more peaceful cohabitation with it. The constant reappearance of lions in Partons au Pas de Blois signals a preoccupation with the relationship between West and East that is also visible in the hero's repeated journeys between France and Constantinople. And the ambivalent way in which the King of the Beasts is presented in this romance speaks volumes about the mixture of fascination and unease that the East inspired in the French nobility in the 1170s. At one point, the anonymous author of Partons au Pas tells us that the lion is such a noble beast that it has to lash itself into a fury with its tail in order to be able to attack other creatures when it's hungry. However, at another point, a ferocious lion, kept in captivity at the court of the Holy Roman Emperor, escapes and attacks the hero's alter ego, Anselot, who is saved from a grisly death only by the intervention of his faithful hound, which kills the lion. But enough of lions. It's time now to return to our main subject and to ask what kinds of insights this process of emotional archaeology can uncover. To answer that question, let me take you on a short tour of some well-known and some less well-known French narratives, pointing out ways in which they can illuminate the inner lives of our medieval counterparts. Our journey will be guided by the question I raised a little while ago. What did people in 12th and 13th century France and Anglo-Norman England do for a laugh? I should preface what follows with a health warning. Old French literature is neither politically correct nor always seemly. So those of a delicate disposition, and I discount all medievalists from this group, those of a delicate disposition should stop listening for the next few minutes. At one level, our medieval counterparts told each other short comic stories, the fabliau, that mined timeless sources of humour such as sex, defecation, and the outwitting of dim but jealous husbands by sharp-witted and unscrupulous wives. Some of these tales are so scabrous and their titles so explicit that 19th and early 20th century editors felt compelled to leave the titles out when committing them to print. Even the 13th century scribe of one of the most famous manuscript collections of these stories couldn't quite bring himself to write out the key words in the rubrics for one or two of them. A good example of this obscene tendency in old French literature is the Songe des Vies, or Dream of the Pricks, in which a frustrated wife dreams of a market devoted entirely to penises, where she can choose exactly the size and shape that suits her. When she wakes up, she lets her husband know that he doesn't measure up to the subject of the dream, but she's cheerfully told that she will just have to make the best of what she's got, and marital harmony is duly restored. This story reveals an interesting balance between, on the one hand, testing the limits of the acceptable in sexual humour, and on the other, the desire to neutralise its subversive potential. In other, less graphic tales, unsatisfied wives get away with taking lovers and duping their husbands. Here, however, it seems as if the explicitness of the dream marks some kind of limit. It cannot be made any worse by adding in adultery or deception. The subversive idea of manhood being a mere commodity and women the purchasers of their own pleasure is also firmly located in the world of dreams and ultimately negated by the wife's acceptance of her real-life situation. If the Songe des Vies had a message for the original audience, then it is surely, dream on, lady. So a closer look at what seems at first to be simply a dirty joke in octosyllabic rhyming couplets reveals a pretty sophisticated understanding of the nature of transgressive humour. Alongside this, we also find fabliau whose humour is firmly grounded in the social and linguistic reality of the period. The little-known poem L'outillement au vilain. Now, the obvious English translation of this is The Peasant's Equipment, which introduces an unfortunate double entendre, which isn't there in the old French original. So this poem is a cautionary tale about marriage, which fits squarely into the tradition of medieval misogyny, but which also gives us real insight into the conditions of rural life at this time. Its author sets out to warn any peasant who may be contemplating matrimony to think again, because of the expense of providing all the equipment that a wife will expect him to provide. To make his point, the author then proceeds to list every item that a would-be husband will require. The humour here derives from the sheer length of the catalogue, which seems never-ending. One list of tools or utensils is immediately followed by another, introduced by the words, s'il y convient, and he will need, and he will need, and he will need, and so on, for some 260 lines. The equipment includes a special kind of hoe for clearing thistles, and a new pair of leather mittens, gardening gloves by any other name, for cutting thorn bushes to build a predator-proof enclosure around the settlement. The poet even includes an obligatory cat, on the left, to protect the huches, which are bins for storing bread and other provisions, from mice. And you will see a very strange-looking medieval mouse down there at the left. And there is in this poem a timely reminder that the Holy Grail wasn't always so holy and had no connection with the church in its first incarnation. Amongst the compulsory kitchen equipment, we find a frying pan and an andiron with attachments for roasting meat over the fire, a soup pot and a ladle, and a gail, probably a serving dish, and a hook for taking meat out of the pot when it's cooked and placing it in the gail, the dish. And the chap you can see at the top there in his left hand has a traditional meat hook for taking a lump of meat out of a pot and putting it onto a serving dish. The message that emerges loud and clear from all these lists is that women are such demanding creatures that marriage is best avoided altogether. But in making his anti-feminist point, the author has left us an important piece of evidence about the detail of everyday life in medieval France. The fabliau of the two Englishmen and the little donkey shows that humour based on national stereotypes was alive and well in the Middle Ages, as this tale revolves around two speakers of English and Anglo-Norman, the French spoken in England at this time, running into trouble because of their problematic pronunciation of French. The racist orientation of the tale is clear from the way in which the two main protagonists are represented as being incapable of speaking either French or English correctly. There's a bastard language, a kind of pidgin French, which invites laughter from a continental audience for whom the tale was written, and confirms their preconception that the English are really rather dim. So when one of the Englishmen, who's been suffering from a fever, tries to tell his companion Alain that he's feeling a little better for having sweated profusely in the night, he comes out with, "Me have toute nuit sué," a sentence in which the English element, "me have," contains the non-English speaker's classic confusion of me and I, while the French element, toute nuit sué, represents the classic non-French speaker's mispronunciation of u, as ou, should be sué, not sué. Right? I don't know whether it's reassuring or depressing to realise that the French have been making fun of our pronunciation for the past 800 years. Although this aspect of this fabliau may be very familiar to us, in other respects, this story emphasises the distance that separates us from the men and women of the 13th century in terms of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in humour. How many mainstream comedians today, and this story was mainstream enough to be included in one of the most famous of all manuscript compilations of medieval French narratives. So how many mainstream comedians today could get away with a joke that hinges on the butchering and eating of a newborn baby donkey? I told you I don't do fluffy. Alain's companion is feeling so much better after sweating out his fever that he feels like eating some lamb. But being an Englishman, he has difficulty pronouncing the sound ny in the French word for lamb, agneau. I'm not going to go into the reason why the spelling doesn't match the pronunciation at this particular period. So what he asks Alain to get for him is agneau, not agneau. Alain sets off in search of one, which leads to more linguistic humour at his expense as he tries to make himself understood by a French townsman. Eventually, the townsman declares that his donkey mare gave birth the night before and brings the newborn donkey, on the left, to Alain, who promptly pays for it. At this point, it becomes clear that Alain, being an Englishman, has interpreted his friend's request for agneau as baby donkey. The Frenchman, not hearing the characteristic ny sound of agneau, has also come to the conclusion that the caller is after a donkey foal. Anti-English sentiments are deeply embedded in these brief exchanges. The Frenchman doesn't ask why Alain wants to cook a little donkey for his friend, which suggests a fairly negative perception of the English and or their cuisine. Alain, we now realise, is apparently too dim to question his companion's strange choice of meal. Alain takes the little creature back to his lodgings where he kills, skins and cooks it. He then gives a whole leg to his companion, who also, being a dim-witted Englishman, wolfs it all down before noticing that the bones are on the big side for a lamb, as you can see from the comparison. The follows a classic, but this isn't Anno, yes it is Anno, no it isn't Anno conversation between the two Englishmen, which ends with, are we getting somewhere? Which ends with Alain bringing in the skin, complete with the head, the ears and the feet, and his companion resolving the linguistic confusion by exclaiming, Sistri, n'est mi fils bé, hé, this isn't the son of a bar. to which Alain replies indignantly, tu dites voir, note the incorrect verb form, he is after all English, par Saint-Félix, fois que je dois Saint-Jean, Sistri fut fils, i-en. You is right, by St. Felix. By the faith I own St. John, this was the son of a hee-haw, hee-haw. Whereupon his friend realises what's happened and bursts out laughing. The story ends with a cheerful comment from the narrator that Alain's friend made a full recovery and suffered no ill effects from his donkey roast. Now, the Fabliaux are explicitly comic tales designed to entertain and raise a laugh, as well as to explore social issues in some cases. But there are other, more serious narratives that can also shed light on how people lived and laughed in our period. One of these is the romance of Il est Galeran, composed in the early 1170s by a poet who names himself as Gautier d'Arras. One episode in this romance shows us high-ranking nobles using sarcasm and mockery to raise a laugh in ways that once again seem very familiar. The hero, Ile, Duke of Brittany, has gone into self-imposed exile in Italy. He presents himself to the emperor in Rome as a poor soldier who will serve in his army for nothing more than food and clothing in return. The emperor agrees, as he's currently at war with the emperor of Constantinople and so needs all the men he can get. And he hands Ile over to his seneschal, saying sarcastically, I beg you earnestly to take on this soldier. He will liberate the country for you and end war and restore peace. Of course, Ile, being the hero, proceeds to do exactly that. But at this point in the narrative, neither the emperor nor the seneschal can have any inkling as to his true identity or prowess. The emperor's joke and the seneschal's answering laughter show humour being used, then as now, to reinforce social bonds and to remind the outsider that he doesn't belong. This motif is repeated a few lines later in a description of the emperor's forces setting out for the battlefield. Ile is given an old, rusty set of armour and weapons that used to belong to a burgess. He rides out with the rest of the army and is subjected to merciless mockery by the great knights from noble families who are all kitted out in fine armour. The verb that's used for both the emperor's and the great knight's cruel joking is gaber, a word of Scandinavian origin that can denote trickery and pretense, as well as a range of verbal behaviour, most of it humorous. Although those who made a living from telling stories are not necessarily objective witnesses, there is nonetheless sufficient evidence from old French fiction to suggest that verbal humour was particularly prized amongst the aristocracy. There's a very interesting example of gaber in this sense in a later 12th century mock epic known as Le Pèlerinage de Charlemagne, Charlemagne's Pilgrimage. In this story, the great Frankish emperor Charlemagne and his followers travel first to Jerusalem, where they acquire an impressive collection of holy relics, and then on to Constantinople again, to find out whether the Byzantine emperor Hugo really does rival Charlemagne in magnificence, as Charlemagne's wife had unwisely suggested in the opening lines of the poem. After feasting with Hugo and drinking rather a lot of his wine, the Franks retire to their bedchamber, where Hugo has hidden a spy to report back on their activities. The Franks settle down, and the narrator tells us, Désors gabèrent le comte et les marquises. In this context, gabère means something closer to English boast than make fun of, although it probably also implies an element of humour. And then the counts and the marquises jokingly exchanged boasts might be an appropriate translation. What we then witness is effectively a ritualised boasting contest, as the emperor and his principal barons take it in turns to entertain one another by describing extraordinary feats they claim to be able to perform. Charlemagne goes first, as befits his rank as emperor, and boasts that he could slice in two, vertically, any man in Hugo's army, even if he were wearing two helmets and two coats of chainmail, one on top of the other, and the sword would go right through his war horse as well, and bury itself in the ground so deeply that it would have to be dug out afterwards. Charlemagne then invites his nephew Roland to go next. The emperor said, "Jest, fair nephew Roland, willingly, my lord, just as you command. Tell King Hugo to lend me his olifant." An olifant is a horn made from an elephant tusk. "Then I will go out of the city onto the plain. I will blow so strongly and the blast will be so violent that no door or postern gate will remain in place throughout the whole of this great city. King Hugo will be very strong if he manages to venture out without having the whiskers burnt off his beard and the great marten furs blown from around his neck and his ermine cloak turned inside out on his back." After this, Béranger boasts that he can throw himself off the highest tower in Constantinople onto a field of upturned swords without suffering so much as a scratch. And so on, until each of the 12 peers has made his gab, and then everyone goes to sleep. Some of these boasts, like Béranger's, are merely fantastical and create humour through their sheer extravagance. Others, however, are designed to play on the audience's prior knowledge of the characters, as they were represented in stories known to have been in wide circulation before the Pèlerinage was composed. So Charlemagne's boast is derived from the convention of the so-called epic blow, a sword stroke that slices man and horse in two, which is attributed in all seriousness to the greatest heroes in old French epic literature. But here, Charlemagne's boast also seems to refer back to the opening episode of the story, where the great emperor was seen congratulating himself on how fine he looked in his crown and how well his sword hung at his side. The humour generated by the exaggeration of a well-known convention via the doubling of the opponent's armour and the disappearance of the sword into the ground underneath the horse, this is reinforced by a nod in the direction of the literary Charlemagne's high opinion of himself. Roland's boast also transposes the high seriousness of epic into a comic register. In the Song of Roland, the oldest and most famous of all the old French chansons de geste, or epics, an ivory horn, an olifant, plays a key role in the unfolding of the drama that leads to the hero Roland's death, along with 20,000 other members of Charlemagne's army. Assigned to the rearguard of the army, Roland and his men are treacherously attacked by a Saracen army that outnumbers them 5-1. Urged by his companion Oliver to sound his horn while the main Frankish army is still within earshot, Roland refuses, claiming that it would be dishonourable to call for reinforcements. There you have an olifant, and here we start with Oliver's words, "Companion Roland, blow your olifant. Charles will hear it as he rides through the past. I swear to you, the Franks will soon return." "God forbid," Roland replies, "that any man alive should say that pagans made me blow the horn. My kinsmen will never have to bear that reproach." Later in the Song of Roland, when his forces have been massacred, Roland does sound the horn, blowing it so hard that, in the poet's words, his temples burst and he dies. But Charlemagne hears the horn blast and returns to avenge the defeat of the rearguard. Roland's boast in the Pèlerinage clearly plays on this famous incident at several different levels. Tragedy becomes comedy as the battlefield at Roncevaux is transformed into a luxurious chamber in Hugo's palace, and the desperate fighting in the Pyrenees turns into an after-dinner boasting contest between drunken knights. The horn blast also shifts from the sublime to the ridiculous, as its symbolic function becomes ludicrously literal. No longer a representation of heroic self-sacrifice and vengeance, it's now a weapon of mass destruction that brings about the discomfiture of the enemy without the need for Roland to die or for Charlemagne to intervene. At the same time, having Roland boast about how hard he can blow his horn supposedly before the action of the Chanson de Roland takes place, provides a neat, ironic commentary on the fashion for prequels that was making its mark on the development of the old French epic at this time. And of course, the boasts themselves are so much hot air, but hot air that will have consequences. As the spy reports back to his master what the Franks have been saying, and Hugo concludes that gabs such as Roland's are a calculated insult to himself, so we have gabere here as mockery as well as comic boasting. Did ritualised comic boasting contests like this actually take place in real life in 12th and 13th century France? It's impossible to be sure, but what happens next in the pèlerinage suggests that it may have done. The following morning, Hugo summons Charlemagne and demands that the Franks make good on their boasts, on pain of death, if they fail to carry each one out to the letter. Charlemagne tries desperately to explain that they were only joking and that this is part of Frankish culture. He says to Hugo, "It is customary in France, in Paris and in Chartres, for the Franks to jest and boast like this when they retire to bed, and they say some things that are sensible and some things that are not so sensible." It's hard to imagine that the author of the Pèlerinage has just invented a Frankish custom for the purpose of sending up some literary heroes. It seems more likely that he decided to exploit a practice that was known to his audience and to develop its comic potential, firstly by associating it with well-known figures, and secondly by showing what might happen if you indulge in this practice of exchanging gabs in an inappropriate context. It may be customary in France, he seems to be saying, but Frankish jokes may not go down too well in Constantinople. For me, Charlemagne's explanation has the ring of truth about it, plus a certain psychological credibility. After all, the gabs are not a million miles away from some present-day conversations between men who have a few drinks inside them. In case you were wondering how the Franks get themselves out of this particular sticky situation, Charlemagne goes off and prays for divine help on the relics that he collected in Jerusalem, and God sends an angel to say that he will help the emperor out on this occasion, but he mustn't do it again. Hugo then makes an unwise choice of the first three boasts to be performed. He doesn't make them do them in order, with the result that he is totally humiliated and has to concede that Charlemagne is the greater emperor, which in turn allows Charlemagne to ride home in triumph, having proved that his wife was wrong. The playful, fantastical nature of the gabs in the Pèlerinage de Charlemagne brings me finally to what I can only describe as the Monty Python tendency in medieval French literature. There is here a vein of surreal humour that surfaces in the 12th century in Hugh de Roteland's romance of Protesilaus, and in the 13th in the anonymous Cristal et Clarie. Hugh was an Anglo-Norman poet and scholar from Rutland in North Wales, not Rutland, despite the sound of it, who lived at one point in a house in Creedon Hill, near Hereford, and had friends amongst the clerics associated with the cathedral there. His first romance, Epomedon, is one of the most irritating narratives I've ever read, and it also has one of the cleverest and most obscene epilogues in the whole of old French literature. Protesilaus, his second romance, is less obviously virtuosic, perhaps, and it's a couple of thousand lines too long, but as compensation, it does have moments of pure creative silliness. Hugh's audience were probably familiar with some, at least, of the Arthurian romances of Chrétien de Troyes, in which knights could challenge other knights to fight on the slightest of pretexts, such as, for example, trying to cross one of their fords without permission, and where a knight might also enter a castle which housed a perilous bed, the occupant of which would find a flaming lance hurtling towards him from the ceiling in the middle of the night. Used in moderation, such arbitrary adventures can help to create an atmosphere of mystery and magic, and to enhance the image of the hero as he proves himself equal to any eventuality. But in Protesilaus, Hugh de Roteland deliberately lets things get out of hand, multiplying or exaggerating random elements until the audience can no longer suspend disbelief and the ludicrous nature of nightly adventure is exposed to view. Let me illustrate this with an example taken from a passage where the hero is travelling through Lombardy on his way to seek military help from his father's former tutor, now ruler of Burgundy. As night approaches, Portesilaus and his companions cross a broad river and encounter a distraught damsel who tells them in no uncertain terms that they are doomed. If they try to go back the way they've come, they will not be able to recross the river without becoming lepers. If they stay where they are, they'll be eaten by wild beasts. If they continue north, they may be able to lodge with the wild maiden. But to gain the right to stay in her castle, Portesilaus will have to spend a night guarding her causeway against the fairy knight who's trying to win her. If he fails to stop the fairy knight crossing the causeway to the castle, he will also become a leper, just like 1,000 other knights who've also come that way this year. The telltale signs of exaggeration are beginning to creep in. How can 1,000 knights have met such a fate already when Hugh has just told us that Lombardy was almost deserted at this period and you could travel for 3 days without encountering anyone? And why does everyone seem to end up with leprosy, no matter which direction they go in? As you would expect, our hero heads north and agrees to guard the causeway. At midnight, he hears the neighing of a horse, and suddenly the fairy knight is upon him. A fierce combat ensues, during which the fairy knight kills Portesilaus' horse and then tries to sneak past when his opponent isn't looking, only for Portesilaus to leap up and drag him off his own charger. The fairy knight then tries to trick the hero into accepting a golden ring, which will put him to sleep and leave the causeway undefended. Eventually, Portesilaus is victorious and cuts off the fairy knight's head, as he's been told that if he just kills his opponent and leaves the body intact, the fairy knight will simply come back to life again the following day. Taken individually, none of these elements is necessarily comic. But put them all together, and this outlandish adventure becomes just too outlandish to be taken seriously. And of course, we must remember that all this is taking place on a causeway, in the dark, and without any explanation of why, having overcome all previous 1,000 guardians of the causeway, the fairy knight hasn't just ridden up to the castle and claimed his prize already. Cristal Éclairé goes several steps further in the game of knowing allusions to stories with which the audience is already familiar. The poet of this romance incorporates whole passages from at least a dozen other narratives and songs into his composition. Some of these extracts are as much as 200 lines long. At some point, his own story of the hero Cristal's quest for a beautiful maiden whom he's seen in a dream is little more than the stitching needed to hold the various pieces in the patchwork together. We can imagine the audience listening with increasing delight as they pitted their wits against the author's in a game of spot the quotation, and wondered how many more of their favourite compositions were going to make an appearance. But there's more to this poet than simply a literary magpie. Parts of his framework story demonstrate a real flair for subverting the stock-in-trade of knightly tales in ways that make Monty Python's quest for a shrubbery seem almost ordinary. Cristal sets out on his quest, accompanied only by his squire Rigal. After riding for a week, they enter a great forest at sundown and realise that they will have to spend the night there. They settle down to rest, but soon fall asleep, and Rigal starts to snore loudly. It so happens that the forest is home to a dragon, which visits the spring next to which Cristal and Rigal are sleeping 4 times every night. In the forest there lived a dragon that dominated all the others. It was so huge and hideous that no one dared go near this evil, this diabolic creature. It was truly hideous beast, 20 feet long from head to tail. Approaching the spring, it hears the unfamiliar noise of snoring. It kept quite still and listened to Rigal, who was snoring loudly. The beast leapt straight at him, seized him round the flanks, and thrust its talons into his innards. The squire's screams wake Cristal, who hastily dons his armour and attacks the dragon, but too late to save Rhaegal. Eventually, Crystal manages to deliver a fatal blow with his sword and the dragon collapses, whereupon Crystal seems to get carried away. He slices the creature's head in two, but then won't stop until he's chopped it into more than 100 pieces. He then collects up the bits of Rhaegal that didn't get eaten by the dragon and gives them a decent burial before riding off into the sunrise. Here, the standard hero kills dragon storyline is humorously reinterpreted by the Crystal poet as a warning against snoring loudly in forests. The incongruous mix of the heroic and the prosaic, the snoring. I don't think I know any other medieval French texts in which people snore, actually, particularly not in forests. So this mixture of the heroic and the prosaic locates the squire's grisly fate firmly in the world of fictional gameplay. Various adventures later, Crystal comes to a meadow, in the middle of which there is a chapel next to a great tree. Underneath the tree, there is a spring and a pond. Finding the chapel locked, he dismounts and goes to drink from the spring, whereupon a damsel, who is sitting up the tree, cries out that he will die if he does so. She then reveals that she has fallen into the clutches of a demon, who has kept her prisoner in the tree for the last 12 years. Although he does allow her to have a wardrobe of over 100 silk robes, and to take shelter in the chapel if the weather turns really nasty. If any passing knight tries to drink from the spring, a giant hand, measuring 3 feet by 2, will reach up out of the water, grab the knight in question, and drown him. If anyone can cut off the hand, which belongs to a water goblin, he can, and then defeat the demon, she will be free to leave and return to her family. Crystal, naturally, being a hero, takes up the challenge and dangles his helmet in the water so that he can strike the hand with his sword as it grabs hold of the helmet. The hand won't give up without a fight, however, and seizes Crystal by the arm, wrenching off the sleeve of his chainmail tunic before disappearing back into the water. Crystal then puts his own hand over the water before quickly drawing it back and cutting through the goblin's wrist with a two-handed sword stroke as the giant hand emerges above the surface. I cannot help hearing echoes here of the intensely serious scene at the end of the early 13th century story of the death of King Arthur, La Mort le Roi Arthur, which also features a lake, a supernatural hand, and a sword. The dying Arthur entrusts his sword Excalibur to one of his followers, instructing him to cast it into a lake near the seashore. Then Girofle threw the sword into the deepest part of the lake, as far away from him as he could. And now as it approached the water, he saw a hand emerge from the lake as far as the elbow, but he saw nothing of the body to which the hand belonged. The hand caught the sword by the hilt and brandished it in the air 3 or 4 times. Well, Girofle had clearly observed this, the hand slid back into the water together with the sword. You note how many times the hand gets repeated in this extract. So is the poet of Crystal et Clary sending up this famous incident from Arthurian romance? I suspect that he is, and that the combat with the hand is another example of just how irreverent medieval authors could be towards the literary productions of their predecessors. Interestingly, this slapstick combat with the hand is then followed by a real fight with the demon, who materialises as a two-headed giant to avenge the death of his companion. But even as the poet appears to be restoring narrative normality by allowing his hero to demonstrate his prowess against a truly formidable land-based enemy, the forces of comedy are once again marshalling in the wings. The demon is conventionally ugly, as hairy as a bear, with blazing red eyes, and he's 17 feet tall. He tries 38 times to crush Crystal with his huge iron mace. This is a poet who understands the comic potential of numbers. And each time, the hero leaps nimbly aside like the trained fencer that he is. Eventually, Crystal sees an opening and goes for his opponent's ankle, cutting off his right foot. The giant falls to the ground and Crystal cuts off one of his heads. But this doesn't seem to deter the giant at all. He promptly sends Crystal flying with a blow from his fist. the battle isn't over until Cristal has picked himself up, cut off both the giant's arms and chopped him in half. That scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail is coming to mind here, isn't it? Once again, the line between enough and too much has been crossed. The audience's willing suspension of disbelief has been tested to its limit and beyond, and laughter escapes through the gap between fiction and reality. So what have we learned at the end of this brief archaeological excavation? Well, we know that people in medieval France and French-speaking England told dirty jokes to entertain one another, and that they did not simply tell them, they also developed some of them into verse narratives and recorded them for posterity. We've also been able to deduce that the idea of women having full sexual autonomy was potentially so explosive in this culture that it had to be diffused through humour and located safely in the realms of fantasy. We've seen that the continental French saw themselves as linguistically superior to their Anglo-Norman cousins and had no qualms about portraying the English as rather dim. Making fun of outsiders seems to have been common practice and broadly acceptable, whether the outsider identified himself by speaking differently or simply by not wearing the latest designer armour. If there was no political correctness in this respect, there was, as we have seen, no sentimentality where animals were concerned in the pursuit of humour. We've uncovered evidence of one rather familiar way in which groups of men entertained themselves after a few drinks. At the same time, the Pèlerinage de Charlemagne demonstrates the existence of a sophisticated literary humour based on playful rewriting of well-established stories. And there are signs here too of a confident culture in which even the great and the good of the national epic literature are not immune to humorous exploitation. Finally, we found that even in the early days of chivalric narrative, the notion of knightly adventure lends itself to hilarious send-ups as much as to serious quests for personal or religious fulfilment. Does this make old French fiction useful? I think so. I hope you agree. Thank you.